Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Thursday, June 24th. There is one item on our agenda today, and before we start working on that item, would you please call the roll for committee attendance?
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke is present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you. We're ready to start with the substantive part of the meeting. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 727A. LRO.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 727 is a legislative workaround to the what's known as the SALT limitation that was part of the Federal Tax Cut and Jobs Act passed in 2017. At the federal level, individuals are allowed to deduct their state and local taxes. Prior to that act, that was more or less an unlimited deduction. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act placed a $10,000 cap on that deduction. And since that time, a number of states have been working to put forth legislation as a workaround to that deduction. And this is Oregon's version. It is based on some other states. But what it basically does is creates a new entity level tax on qualified pass-through entities. So these are your S corporations, partnerships, LLCs, treated as those entities. And at the same time that it creates this tax, it creates a credit equal to that tax. So in that sense, the policy is designed to be revenue neutral for the state. The value of it for taxpayers is that if this income tax is paid by the entity, those taxes are fully deductible against their federal taxes. So that's the value for the individual entities. The tax itself is a 9% rate for income up to $250,000 and a 9.9% rate above $250,000. And the Oregon version does limit the qualifying entities to those where the owners are individuals subject to the personal income tax or other pass-through entities whose owners are subject to the personal income tax. So it's limited to a two-tiered structure. As some of the committee members know, some of these entities can be pretty complicated, but that is one limiting factor. And this would be in place for 2 years, tax years 22 and 23. You do have a dash A5 amendment, which would repeal this provision in either of those years if Congress were to act and repeal the limitation effective for those 2 years. And also included in the A5 is a technical clarification about an ORS reference. And you do have all of that's the description of it, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions before we get to our witness list? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, and Mr. Allenack, on that dash 5 amendment, is that something that could be added like in a short session? Does that have to be done now, or can we come back at a different time and also put in that clarification? Could we add it on later, I guess is my question.
Vice Chair Reschke, Chair Nathanson, I think you could add it on later. The potential value of including it now is that the taxes begin, if we just think through the logistics, the tax begins January 1, 22. So you certainly could delay action until the February session. However, as you'll see, if you've had a chance to look at the paperwork, there is a fiscal to it. So, and Department of Revenue is in the room, so they'll be able to speak more clearly to this. But I would imagine there's a ramp up of expenditures that could happen before then. And so the value of the A5 is if Congress were to act, say, this year, then this could be repealed before we got started. It kind of depends. There's a lot of unknowns about if and when and how Congress would act.
Yeah. A quick follow-up comment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. So my reason for asking that question is we're getting close to the end of session. I don't know how long the Senate's going to be here. And one thing I am, you know, if we're going to move this forward or consider it, is I don't want to have another hoop to jump through by it having to go back to the Senate for concurrence if they have left the building already, so, or if they're not going to work it. So that's my only concern on the A5 is more timing than it is per se the actual content of the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Rushke. Let's see, Rep. Pham, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I did have a question about, do we have any sense of the income level of the entities that would benefit? Because I understand that you'd have to have over $10,000 or more in state taxes for the cap to kick in. So do we have an income breakdown in terms of who would who's going to benefit the most from this? Chris, Mr. Allen.
Representative Pham. I don't have an income level right now. I might be able to look one up while the media is going on, get back to you later, but it is going to be the higher income folks that have, that level of income. If you just factor in the $10,000 applies to both income taxes and property taxes, with state and local taxes. And most of those are the state income tax and then the property tax, although you have other taxes if you're in the Portland area, so that it's a combination of factors. So it can depend on the value of one's home as well as just the income in terms of the income tax.
Okay, yeah, if there's any data on that, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yep. And one question I'd like to ask, when you mentioned income, is this the income that we sometimes hear about as business ordinary income? And we're really talking about profit, not just all of your sales.
For the new tax or the, it's on the profits.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Nathan, this is Pam. Yes. I have a question. I think I'm off the screen.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. I don't want to interrupt, but Chris, my questions are really in the realm of your answers to Rep. Pham. The SALT limitation applies to income and property taxes, and I just want to clarify that this is a fix, not for the whole problem, but for given taxpayers who have an income tax issue, correct? I mean, there's still going to be a lot of taxpayers out there who are subject to the SALT limitations will not be able to use this particular fix. Is that correct?
That's correct, Rep. Marsh. This particular fix, if you think of all of the individuals filing the personal income taxes that are affected by this limitation of that pie, of that 100% pie, only those that are business owners are affected by this. So it's only the business owners that this applies to. So if somebody is higher income and they're affected by that limitation, but they're not a business owner, they're not a shareholder in an LLC or partnership or S-Corp, they would be unaffected by this.
And further, a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Is that even the business owners can't, this is just for their income tax paid, not for their property tax paid, correct?
Correct. That's correct. It's the entity would pay the income tax, and that income tax is fully deductible at the federal level. So their net income gets reduced at the federal level. There's no change in the Oregon tax. I mean, they'll get the credit against the income tax, to offset the tax paid by the entity. It's basically shifting where the tax is paid. Is the instead of the tax being paid by the owner, it's being paid by the entity.
Okay, so I guess I have a more fundamental question just to make sure I understand what we are talking about. The entity gets to, does this apply to their income, their Oregon income tax or Oregon property tax or both that they're able to?
The net change, so the entity will pay this tax.
Yeah.
So the net income for the entity is less. And so all of that, we're talking about pass-through entities here. So it'll go through to the individuals. So when they file their federal income tax, their net taxable income is less, which lowers their federal tax liability. When they go to calculate their Oregon tax, aside from the credit involved, their Oregon tax should be unchanged. That's the intent of the policy. And we've gone through it and we've checked with stakeholders. There could be some odd circumstances or some rare circumstances where that isn't exactly true, depending on some unique circumstances, but that's generally how it's, that's how it's designed.
Okay, thank you, that's very helpful.
So before calling on Rep. Reschke, I just wanna follow up then on this conversation with the questions from Rep. Marsh and Mr. Alanak. It's designed to be revenue neutral for state revenue. And if this bill were to pass, money that otherwise would have been going to the federal government now stays in Oregon. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. That's the policy intent, and that's the workaround, or what it's, I guess, workaround is a slang, but by lowering the federal tax, that is more income is kept by these Oregon businesses and stays in state, if you will, rather than going to the federal government is the large policy intent.
Great, thank you. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions for legislative counsel if they're in the room, or if it would be better to hear from those who have signed up to testify first, I'm fine on waiting for after that. So your discretion.
Well, let's go ahead and ask that question because I did see legislative counsel in the room. Let's make sure we understand how everything works. And I'm very hopeful that those people who've signed up to testify can stay with us for a few minutes more.
All right, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Ms. Toswell, thanks for being here. I've got about four questions, if you would be so kind to answer them. The first one is, and I think this one's obvious, that Senate Bill 727 does not require a three-fifths vote. Is that correct?
Good afternoon. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, Vice Chair Pham, members of the committee, I'm Kate Toswell from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And as for the first question for Senate Bill 727, the engrossed version, yes, it's my understanding that that would not be a bill for raising revenue and would not require a three-fifths vote. In a nutshell, essentially, if we are analyzing a bill to see whether it's a bill for raising revenue under Article 4, Section 18 or Article 4, Section 25, of the Oregon Constitution. Both of those provisions apply to bills for raising revenue. They use the same analysis in the courts. And under Oregon case law, we look first to see if a bill brings revenue into the state treasury. And after that's the first part of the test under basically the leading case, which is Bobo versus Kulongoski. If we answer that question, no, we don't proceed to the second part of the test, which is, does the bill have the essential features of a bill levying a tax? So in the case of 727A, my understanding is this is designed, it's set up to be revenue neutral because the credit is calculated based on the amount of the tax. So it would not bring revenue into the state coffers. It would affect federal tax liability, but the issue is, are we bringing money into the Oregon Treasury? So the answer to the first question, I think, is a pretty clear no, it's not a bill for raising revenue, doesn't need a supermajority.
Thank you. So my second question is, and I'll probably combine my second and third one here together. So if a future legislature, or if we in the future here decide to lower or eliminate the credit, would that action require a three-fifths vote? So if another bill came along that said, we're going to eliminate the credit but keep the tax, would that require a three-fifths vote?
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee, that question might be slightly more nuanced, a little bit more complicated, but I think, again, the answer there is it would not be a bill for raising revenue and would not require a supermajority. The next case that we look at, the more recent case that interprets the constitutional provisions around bills for raising revenue, is the case City of Seattle versus Oregon Department of Revenue. And in that case, the bill actually did, there were certain nuances and complications, but at the end of the day, the bill did bring revenues in. And then the Oregon Supreme Court looked at the features of the bill. In that case, there was actually a property tax deduction that was repealed. It was repealed for certain utilities. It was an electrical case. And even though certain taxpayers ended up paying more, the Oregon Supreme Court said this does not have the essential features of a bill levying a tax. This is a bill that repeals a property tax exemption. So we made it through the first part of the Bobo test. It did increase revenues. There were taxpayers who paid more, but then the second part of the test was not satisfied. One issue that might be out there is there some sort of distinction? Is it distinguishable to look at exemptions, deductions, or credits? And there's nothing that tells us that there would be, but I do maybe highlight a little bit. This is a credit as opposed to a deduction or an exemption. But everything that we've seen so far would suggest no. For the second two questions, even if either this legislature or a future one were to come along and reduce the amount of the credit or eliminate the credit, our understanding is that's not going to be a bill for raising revenue.
Okay. My next question then, thank you for that answer. My next question is, if this legislature or future legislature decides to make this tax mandatory, because right now I believe it would be elective, if it were made mandatory, would that require a three-fifths vote?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Rep. Reschke, that question, again, might be slightly more nuanced. I am not necessarily certain whether that would bring in revenues. It might be that enough people who were not paying it were affected by having to pay a mandatory tax. There could be other levers that were at work, so it's not clear to me I don't know just by hearing that what the revenue impact would be. I don't know that making it mandatory necessarily would make it closer to having the features of a bill levying a tax. I think that might be a case of first impression where the courts would have to look at that and say, how do we apply this language in the Constitution to that fact pattern? We had this elective tax, which is unusual, and we're now saying it's mandatory. So I think those are kind of the two sides of the analysis there, and it might actually turn on what happens with the first part of the test, the first prong of Bobo versus Kulongoski, which is, does it bring in money? So I'm not sure we have a clear-cut answer on that one.
Okay, thank you for that. And my last question, thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me ask these, is Senate Bill 139, which we have on the House floor later this afternoon, was the pass-through entity tax adjustment that does raise revenue but lowers rates, actually. When it was in the Senate, there was a dash 10 and a dash 14 considered, but not added. And basically what the dash 10 and 14 would have done would have merged 727 and 139 together. So if they had passed out as a single package, the revenue raising of 139 and this new tax on 727, would that have required a three-fifths vote? If those two things had been put, if those two bills had been merged together, I'm wondering if that would require a three-fifths vote. And I know that didn't happen, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee, that question is an interesting question because it does combine a number of components, some of which we haven't actually seen play out in the courts. Again, both of those bills by themselves only require a simple majority, even though I believe it's 139, would have a positive revenue impact. There were there would be certain taxpayers who would be able to have lower rates and other taxpayers who would be precluded from using the program in 316-143 because of not having not meeting the qualifications as far as the employee ratio or the income ratio. So at the end of the day, there would be certain taxpayers paying more. There would be revenue coming into the state treasury. I don't know if a court looking at a bill that's almost more like an omnibus bill and where there's another tax that is imposed on another set of taxpayers, whether what that connection would be, whether, say, Oregon Tax Court or the Oregon Supreme Court will look at that and say, well, it does have the features of a bill levying a tax, and we've already met the first prong of BOBO. I think it's possible that it might be too attenuated, where the people who are actually paying the tax, which also is an elective tax, but it is a new tax. The people who are paying the tax are not necessarily the people who are responsible for the increase in revenue. So I think that is a question. That's an interesting question, and it might be very factually specific, both in terms of how our office would look at that and also how eventually a court would look at that. It might be very factually dense, depending on exactly how that were implemented. So I guess in looking at it, it seems as if the bills by themselves do not require a supermajority and don't have the origination clause issue that they'd have to be House bills. I'm not sure that combining them would affect that. But I think, again, it's a factually dense, it's a fact pattern that I'm not totally comfortable with.
I appreciate the chair for letting me ask those questions, and Ms. Toswell for your expertise. I'm done at this point for right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Marsh. Okay, I'm going to follow up then with something. Ms. Toswell, you used the word elective. I think it's important for us to go back and make sure we understand we understand the basic premise on this bill and how it relates to pass-through entities. This bill is about pass-through income, but a business entity and an individual can pay taxes without using this provision. It's my understanding that this whole thing is part of a voluntary system or a process that can be used in our tax code, that you can elect to pay your taxes in a more, on a sort of standard way, or you can elect to use this provision, whichever is to your benefit. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, so under Senate Bill 727A, yes, the whole program would be elective. A taxpayer could just proceed in the normal course of business, or they could elect to use this, set this up, have the entity pay the tax, and the entity members would have to consent to do that and then avail themselves of the credit. So the whole program would be elective in that sense.
Okay, and it would be, I would assume that any entity and any individual is going to figure out, it's pretty rational, which method of taxation is to their benefit, and they're going to pick the one that's better for them, for their situation.
Chair Nathanson, I think that's absolutely right. And we see that in other areas of the law, certainly in terms of the elective lower rates that are addressed in Senate Bill 139, and then other situations where people are deciding whether they're going to file as joint, married filers are going to file joint or separately. People run both sets of numbers and decide what's going to be more advantageous for their particular situation.
Thank you. Any other questions for Legislative Council or LRO before we go to our witness list? Not seeing any. Okay. For the public hearing, we have four witnesses signed up. I will say the names in the order that I would like them to testify. Greg Peden, Bennett Menton, Phil Donovan, Ben Gilley. So we will start with Greg Peden.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Greg Peden. here on behalf of a number of clients that are LLCs or S-Corps, small businesses, specifically Metropolitan Land Group, Fortify Holdings, and Downtown Development Group. I had some prepared comments, but I think maybe it'd be best if I just sort of responded to some of the debate that's been addressed already. So just a quick history. The full deductibility of your state and local taxes for LLCs and S-Corps was always allowed in the federal tax code from the beginning of the federal tax code in 1913 to 2017. In 2017, Trump administration put the $10,000 limit in that tax bill. This bill is the is based on IRS guidelines that came out last winter to provide states with a solution to work around that $10,000 limit. To my knowledge, all of the other states in the country that rely heavily on income taxes, like Oregon does, have passed or are passing this exact language in their states because it's based on those federal guidelines. So, for example, California, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey have all passed this exact language. I think that's important to just give you a little context of what we're doing here. This is not some crazy scheme that I thought up or my clients thought up or anybody else in Oregon thought up. And it's to rectify the problem that was created in 2017. It's not a new idea or a new a tax deduction in that sense. Second, I wanted to address a question raised by Representative Pham, which is, who does this apply to? Well, it applies to any small business, any LLC or S-Corps, large businesses, any small business that pays more than $10,000 in federal taxes. Anybody who pays less than $10,000 in federal taxes today already can fully deduct all of their state and local taxes against their federal liability. So that's why it's a limitation that's in place now. So it's just bringing anybody who pays more into the same standard as anybody that pays less. So I just wanted to clarify that a little bit. Finally, I think the most important part of this bill is that it's rectifying something at the federal level that's going to greatly benefit a variety of different types of businesses all over the state. And I think that's a good thing. And then the fact that it's revenue neutral to our Oregon state budget is the best thing about this. This is something that we can do right now as businesses are beginning to recover from COVID. That helps us here in Oregon, keeps us competitive with other states around the country, and isn't going to negatively impact the state budget in any way. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I don't see any hands up right now, but can you stay around in the room with us in case a question comes up?
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Bennett Minton.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bennett Minton on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon. We are a network of volunteers who advocate for a rational and equitable tax code. If a friend asked me for a recent example of how the legislature transfers the tax Oregonians pay to the wealthy among us, I would cite this bill. As has been noted, in 2017, Congress limited the itemized deduction for SALT to $10,000. The effect of the limitation, along with other changes, was to push most itemizers to the standard deduction, and as a result, many found their tax bills went up. A narrative about the 2017 Act was that the Republican-controlled Congress had a political aim, harming taxpayers in blue states by limiting the SALT deduction. The intent was to pressure Democratic states to cut taxes and the services that fund them. There is a counter narrative. Eliminating deductions results in a more progressive tax code because they are of greater benefit to taxpayers in higher brackets. Deductions are regressive. In any event, as has been discussed here for the last 15 minutes, many states tried workarounds, but they didn't fly until New Jersey came up with one that the IRS signed off on. And put simply, it would allow certain pass-through entities to to elect an alternate regime, as the chairwoman said, that enables their owners to claim an unlimited federal SALT deduction. It is supposed to have no revenue effect on Oregon tax collections. But in fact, implementation would cost $1.4 million, according to the LRO, and the pending budget reconciliation bill would allocate $439,000 for this purpose. We testified in detail on an earlier version of this bill in Senate Finance, and a serious flaw was resolved in the bill before you. But the fundamental outrage remains. It's a loophole for the rich. You would take $1.4 million from all Oregonians for the benefit of a select group of business owners who have the money and sophistication to exploit the deduction not generally available. To emphasize, not every taxpayer will take advantage of it, even of those for whom it is available. It is this former group of taxpayers that I assume Robert O'Neill is referring to in the testimony he filed this afternoon. Mr. O'Neill finds problematic the limitation requiring the election at the entity level rather than at the partner level. This is the issue we addressed in our Senate testimony. Mr. O'Neill wants all partners to be able to choose, which, as he notes, would include those in multi-tiered partnerships and C-corps. That's the change made in the Senate, which we wholeheartedly endorse, because to do otherwise, DOR would be inundated with complex returns that we suspect the department may not have the resources to analyze. I spent most of my career in the tax world alerting tax lawyers and clients to these opportunities. The Senate was wise to close them off. Nevertheless, we find this bill appalling. Your former colleague, Lynn Finley, a Senate Finance Republican, said on the floor last week that this bill was, quote, the wrong approach, unquote, and that he was shocked to agree with Bernie Sanders. So was I. He did not elaborate. I would like to think that it is because he does not like taking money out of his constituents' pockets and giving it to multimillionaires. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Bill Donovan, and that will be followed by Ben Gilley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan, and I'm here on behalf of King State Winery and Miletus Beverage, two family-owned businesses here in Oregon that would like to see Senate Bill 727 pass. First, about King Estate. King Estate is located 23 miles southwest of Eugene in the Lorain Valley. Prior to the pandemic, King Estate employed 150 people. In the depths of the pandemic, employment plummeted to 63 people. The pandemic has been devastating, but King Estate is slowly and carefully reopening and has already added back 20 people. Ed King asked me to convey to you that he is against special tax breaks for the wealthy, but the current tax code uniquely penalizes Oregon, and he urges your support for this legislation. Second, Miletus Beverage is a fourth generation, family-owned and operated distribution business located on Swan Island. Over the years, the distribution industry has seen dramatic consolidation by larger corporations and private equity firms. That said, Miletus Beverage has continued to grow, much of that through our portfolio of Oregon craft beer. Through investing in our people, infrastructure, Miletus has been able to remain a leader in distribution. I'm proud to report and represent that Miletus Beverage provides healthcare for all of their employees and their families. They offer a union pension and a company 401k, along with industry-leading wages, most of which are over $20 an hour. Now, through Senate Bill 727, Miletus Beverage will be able to continue to reinvest in our company, people, and infrastructure, while not finding ourselves at a disadvantage versus competitors who are not set up as pass-through entities. So with that, I thank you for your time. I hope you'll pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. And last will be Ben Gilley.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ben Gilly here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Revenue. So written testimony has already been submitted, and I'm here to provide a brief overview of the initial costs that would be incurred for us to implement a new bill or new program such as this, and then also answer any questions the committee may have related to those costs. As Chris stated, Senate Bill 727 applies to tax years 2022 and 2023. And as expected, there are initial costs that are associated with bringing up a new program. For example, we will need to set up our accounting systems to be able to handle a new tax program. For the entities, we'll need to create a new form for them to be able to report the tax. And the specific bill also provides instructions for the department to provide an electronic means for businesses to be able to file this return. We'll also need to update our processing systems to be able to process returns along with the payments. And then there's impact also to individual owners where we'll need to update our personal income tax forms to create a way for them to be able to claim the refundable credit. In addition to that, it's been mentioned that this can be fairly complex, and so we're going to need to do some training with staff and then also educating our tax professional community, getting the word out to businesses about this new program and how it works. And then also for software vendors who want to support this form on as part of their filing suite, then we would need to work with them. And then we anticipate a significant number of questions related to this. Again, because of its complexity, but also at some point in time, we will need to reconcile the entity payments with owner refundable credits claimed to ensure that this is this remains revenue neutral. And so I just wanted to speak to the -A5 amendments as well. Again, as Chris mentioned, if Congress repeals the SALT limitations, then this workaround no longer is necessary. And so the department would like that authority if this is no longer needed for us to stop work on implementing this new tax program. Now with, again, timing of, if they were to repeal it, timing is critical as well. For us, because it affects tax years 2022 for returns filed in 23, we would begin doing work already in January of 2022. So if they were to repeal this by the end of the year, there wouldn't be any sunk costs. However, as we get later and later into 2022, then there would be some sunk costs associated already with, again, the development of the administrative procedures. So with that, I'm going to stop now and see if you have any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, I'm not seeing any hands yet.
Oh, Rep. Nathanson, this is Rep. Smith.
There you are. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Benjamin, you just discussed with the committee what it would take to stand up this new process, this new program. Isn't that typical of the department every time the legislature decides to bring a new program to the table?
Yes, Representative or Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith, that is correct. And so just like the other legislation that will be passed this session, we will have programs and provisions to implement into our tax systems.
Follow up.
Yes, go ahead.
And so in the past, the Department of Revenue has successfully implemented new programs, and it would appear to me under the leadership of the director that while there are multiple steps that have to occur, this is typical, and the staff that would need to step up is in place and has the expertise to stand up new programs. Is that fair?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith. Yes, that is fair. So We do have established processes now. We, on an annual basis, look for new law changes, and we update our forms and publications, instructions, our processing system. The difference here is it is a new tax program, and so it's not necessarily, it would be similar to some other tax programs that have been recently brought up, but it depends really on the service level that we want to provide to current filers. And so if we need to take in new tax programs, we'll have to find a way to schedule them in to the resources that we have. And so additional programs have additional requirements, especially with new programs, just like a rocket. It consumes a lot of fuel in initial takeoff. And so what's reflected in our fiscal is anticipation of those additional costs, where we can continue to minimize the impact to current filers.
Just one quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
My understanding of the Department of Revenue is that about 6 years ago, they came to the legislature and asked for a significant investment to develop the GenTax system. And one of the things that the legislature was told was that that system or that model is very adaptable. And once the input is placed, the ability to handle new types of programs is much, much simpler. Is that fair?
Yes. Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith. Yes. Yeah, so over the last 6 years, we have shifted a lot of that knowledge and programming to be able to handle these type of new requests. I would say the biggest cost still would not necessarily be related to the computer system. It's really staff hours to be able to create these new forms, to be able to respond to questions, to be able to provide direction to tax professionals and to businesses. And so I think that's somewhat reflected in the fiscal.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson, can I just make a comment and then I'll go back on mute?
Yes, please.
You know, everything that Benjamin has shared with us, I would concur with. As the chair of general government, I have an opportunity to work closely with the Department of Revenue. And I'm of the belief that I have every bit of confidence that should this proceed forward, while it would be new, would take some effort, the Department of Revenue really now has an established reputation for taking on these types of projects, implementing them, and reporting back to the legislature on the great job they did. And so I would anticipate the Department of Revenue would be able to continue with that approach. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And I'm gonna tack in following your statement that when I look at this, there are a couple of ways to interpret the fiscal impact. Sometimes there is a very clear need and plan to hire additional permanent staff, and so that kind of fiscal impact is reported to us. It's also possible that the fiscal impact could be, well, here's the value of the time that would be necessary to dedicate to make this thing happen, but it wouldn't necessarily involve hiring wholly new permanent staff to accomplish that. And I think that is consistent with some of what I'm hearing from Representative Smith's remarks. So I didn't want to put words in your mouth, Rep. Smith, but I think that how I'm thinking through this may be more or less in alignment with some of your thoughts. Rep. Smith, did you want to make another statement?
I'm sorry. I would just concur with exactly what you said, Rep. Nathanson. I'll put my hand.
Thank you. And one quick question. For Mr. Gilley, I did make a note of your mentioning the need to create new forms, to update processing systems, and then to be working with the software vendors, because people who do electronic filing and so forth. I'm assuming, though, that those software vendors, since this legislation has been this exact or similar with the same intent, statutory language has been passed in a number of other states already, that those software vendors are used to handling this particular change or upgrade, and therefore the work from Oregon's Department of Revenue to provide them advice and instruction, that effort is probably much reduced, because we're not asking them to invent the wheel or reinvent a wheel. It's just, please do what you've already done. I think it should be easier for them. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, thank you for those comments. Yeah, we do try to, as they work with many different states, then they do use that information to assist in bringing up other states. One thing that they do consider, I know, is with this being a two-year program, whether they would invest that initial time in order to create or support these forms. And so, but for those that are choosing to support, then they would probably have a head start having worked with other states already.
Thank you. That was a good phrase to use. They've got a head start on it since they've done something similar before. Thank you. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a quick question, but in response to the fact that this is just a two-year program, could LRO explain some of the reasoning behind why it's only a two-year program? If the salt tax cap actually exists beyond that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Pham, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. On the Senate side, there were a couple of pieces in play. The salt limitation that was enacted at the federal level, first of all, is only in place through tax year 25. Mm-hmm. So it's limited in duration anyway. So then you get this question of, well, it's not needed after that point. So do we make it in effect for tax years 22 through 25? Another piece of the discussion on the Senate side was in line with some of Vice Chair Reschke's questions around a 3/5 about implementing both of these pieces and then repealing the tax credit. So in light of trying to address those concerns, the idea was, well, if we make it as short as possible, then there's less room over time for those actions to occur. And so 1 year seemed a little too quick, and 2 years was kind of that sweet spot, if you will. And those were the discussions at the federal level. I certainly can't speak to what the different members were thinking, but those were some of the conversations. The limited nature at the federal level and the concern of implementing both pieces and then eliminating the tax credit.
I see. Thank you for that.
Thank you for the question and the responses. I'm not seeing any other hands up. I'd like to have a motion on the table so that we have something specific to discuss. Representative Reschke, yes. The public hearing and the work session, indeed. And I'm going to confirm one last time that completes the list of witnesses for the public hearing.
Yes, it does, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Then I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 727A. And now I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 727A. Thank you, Mr. Alanak, for keeping me on track. Rep. Reschke, could we have a motion?
Sure. Chair Nathanson, I move the -5 amendment to Senate Bill 727A.
Vice Chair Reschke moves the -5 amendment to Senate Bill 727A. Is there discussion on this? Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I think the -A5 amendment makes sense. If the federal government repeals this salt cap, I do think that this policy should also go away. But I do want to just put on the record some of my concerns about the inequities in terms of who is going to be disproportionately benefiting from this and who is not going to be benefiting. After I wrote that, or after I phrased my question, I did some research and found the Institute on Tax Education and Policy, and they had some interesting data about other states that have implemented or repealed the salt cap, and they found that in New Jersey, 2/3 of the household of the benefits of $2 out of $3 going to New Jerseyans as a result of the salt cap repeal would flow to white families earning more than $200,000 a year. That's 2/3, even though they only make up 9.8% of all households in the state. So, they went through all of the different data from Hispanic families to Black families and really just highlight both the economic inequalities as well as the racial inequalities in terms of who would benefit. So I just I'm concerned that this would be a tax break mostly for high income business owners. And it would still cost Oregon $1.4 million to implement. And so I think it's something that we should. It's something I can't support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other discussion on this motion for the -5 amendment? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I am very hopeful that the federal, our colleagues in the federal government will in fact fix the salt deduction. And so I'm anxious for this amendment so that we call off all the workers as soon as possible once that happens.
Thank you, Rep. Marsh. I'm not seeing any other hands. Did I miss anyone? Let's have a roll call vote on this motion for the amendment.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes no.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. That motion passes. Can we have another motion, please?
Chair Nathanson, I move Senate Bill 727A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Reschke moves Senate Bill 727A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on this motion. Representative Reschke.
Thank you. I'll be real quick. I do have concerns about this approach. And my question is about the 3/5 majority needed to remove the tax credit or to make the tax mandatory give me pause in the sense that I'm afraid we're finding a way around the 3/5 requirement to create new taxes. What you do is you create a tax with an identical tax credit, and that doesn't require 3/5. And then later you take away the tax credit and have a tax, but that doesn't require a 3/5 either. So I'm gonna be, I understand the policy, I understand it's short term, I understand all that. So I'm gonna be a courtesy yes at this point, but I'm still wrestling with this.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Pham wants to talk.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you, Rep. Levy. I guess I'm another courtesy. Yes, there's just some ambivalence in this group around this legislation. I think I really worry that making some repair or some work, developing these workarounds undermines the pressure for the federal government to do a comprehensive fix. And this is a workaround that's only available to some taxpayers for the state taxes, not the local taxes. And so it's really just it's not comprehensive, and it's just a workaround. But recognizing that, I think we have been our taxpayers have been unfairly treated by the federal government, I will be a courtesy yes to get this to the floor.
Thank you, Rep. Marsh. And I'd like to concur with some of the comments from Rep. Marsh and others. Yes, this is a workaround, but this is a two-year tax treatment. It's limited duration. It's addressing something that the federal government did to Oregon that didn't help Oregon taxpayers. And this is a way to keep some of Oregon's tax money in Oregon rather than it going to the federal government. So for those reasons and others, I will support this limited time way of treating our tax code. I'm not seeing any other hands. I'm gonna take down Rep. Marsh's hand if I can. And it's time for a roll call vote.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes yes. Courtesy yes.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes no.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes no.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke gives a courtesy aye vote.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson votes aye. The motion passes. For now, let's see, I will assign myself to be the carrier. Any other points to make on this before I close this work session? We're done with this work session. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 727A. Mr. Alanak, anything else to tell us about before we adjourn?
No, Madam Chair, you have completed the agenda for today. I don't know if this is the final meeting or not.
Madam Chair, may I get a you?
Rep. Smith, anything else?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I apologize. I didn't hear who the carrier is.
I will assign myself to be the carrier, and if you'd like to discuss it after the meeting, we can certainly do that.
If you need any help, you just let me know if I can be of service to you.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. Representative Marsh?
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Nathanson, Chair Nathanson. And I'm sort of assuming this could be, likely is, our last meeting of this committee for this session. And I want to thank you for your always graceful conduct of our operations and for your patience when all the time I forget to put down my hand. This virtual world has been challenging, and some of us still haven't quite mastered it. So thank you very much for leading us through these last 6 months.
Those are very nice comments. Thank you very much. And stay tuned. You never know. We might get together again very soon. All right. Watch your email. Otherwise, bye for now. We're adjourned.
Thanks, everyone.